Governor Doug Ducey has named new members to the commission responsible for selecting Court of Appeals and state Supreme Court candidates. And for the first time in more than a year, the governor selected several Democrats. The Commission on Appellate Court Appointments is supposed to reflect the state's diversity, but Democrats have complained Ducey has ignored that requirement in large part. Until these latest appointments, the commission had no Democrats and only one non-white member. With me now to talk about why that matters and what this means is Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Mirror.
Good morning.
So let's briefly talk first off, what does this commission do, the Commission on Appellate Court Appointments?
Well, mostly its primary duties are it vets and selects candidates for the Arizona Court of Appeals and Arizona Supreme Court. When there's a vacancy in one of those courts, it's filled by an appointment from the governor, but the governor doesn't get to pick whoever he wants. People who want to apply for these positions send their applications to this 15-person commission. They vet the candidates and they send a list to the governor, and he has to choose from that. But once every 10 years, this commission also has to do the same thing for applicants to the Independent Redistricting Commission, the 5-member body that redraws our legislative and congressional districts every decade.
And that obviously will be coming up very soon after the 2020 census. So let's get to the complaint that some Democrats, especially in the legislature, had, which is that they were accusing the governor of not really following the rules on the makeup of this commission, right?
Right. Now, according to the Arizona Constitution, the makeup of this commission is supposed to more or less reflect the diversity of Arizona's population. You could interpret that a lot of different ways, politically, racial and ethnically, gender, all kinds of things. But what we've seen for more than the past year is that this commission did not have a single Democratic member. And I don't think that had ever happened since this commission was formed in the mid-1970s. It was a bunch of Republicans and some independents, some of whom very clearly had very strong Republican ties. One of them was a former precinct committee woman for the Republican Party. One was, married to the daughter of a Republican state legislator. And so there's a lot of Republicans and some independents, not all of whom seemed, as independent as the Democrats would like. And so for the past year or more, they've been kind of sounding the alarms about what this might mean when this commission meets to select these candidates for the redistricting commission.
So what do we know about the Democrats that the governor has now appointed to this commission?
Well, there were three of them. So now you have 8 Republicans, 4 independents, and 3 Democrats on this commission. One is Kevin Taylor from Pinal County. He's a former, 2-time candidate for Pinal County Sheriff. You have Emin Barker, who is a prosecutor up with the Coconino County Attorney's Office. And then you have James Zeeler up from Apache County, who's a former police officer, former sheriff's deputy. Also, interestingly enough, though he's a Democrat, he was about 6 years ago appointed to the Game and Fish Commission by then Governor Jan Brewer, who is a Republican, which is kind of interesting for a Democratic member.
Right. Is it worth noting, do you think, that all three of these Democrats are from outside the Phoenix and Tucson metro areas?
Somewhat. I mean, one of the things when the Constitution says that the Commission on Appellate Court Appointments has to reflect the state's population, a big part of that is geographically. You can only have so many members from one county. So it's supposed to reflect, in addition to diversity in a lot of other ways, it's supposed to reflect kind of the geographic diversity of the state.
And we've seen, for example, the state Democratic Party send out a release after these appointments saying that they're happy that the governor has done this. Have these appointments satisfied his critics?
I mean, the critics are still critical, as they're going to tend to be. Certainly, there's not as many Democrats as the Democratic Party and Democratic lawmakers would like. Not as many non-white members as they'd like. But if nothing else, there will probably still be some complaints, especially since we're only about a month away from the end of the application process for redistricting commissioners. And after that, the commission will start really vetting these folks. But if nothing else, this may potentially head off a lawsuit. There was talk. It did not sound like there were any particular plans in the works, which was kind of surprising. There's at least talk that Democrats could sue or try to sue to change the composition of this commission on the basis of that provision of the Constitution. This will probably make that not a very feasible option. You could argue that Democrats make up almost a third of the state. They should make up almost a third of this commission. But I have
Right.
a hard time seeing the Arizona Supreme Court saying, okay, well, you have three, you should have four, and overturn it in that way.
Got it. All right. That is Jeremy Duda with the Arizona Mirror. Jeremy, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
As we've seen so many Arizonans lose their job as a result of the pandemic and the economy remains dire, more people are going hungry. Food insecurity has remained at elevated levels since the pandemic began, according to the Brookings Institution. And for kids, the situation is even worse. Their analysis finds there are about 14 million children in the country without enough food to eat. That's nearly three times as many as there were in 2008 at the peak of the Great Recession. So how is this playing out here in Arizona? And without schools in session for longer than normal, where can children here get access to food? For answers to those questions and more, I got a hold of Angie Rogers, president and CEO of the Association of Arizona Food Banks. And we started with the numbers. Do we know how bad the problem is here? How many Arizona children are facing food insecurity and hunger because of the pandemic?
We have some good numbers. In a typical month, school meals provide about 600,000 children with access to meals at school. So those kids are able to receive free and reduced price meals during the school year in a typical month. So in a typical month, schools would provide about 14 million meals to kids. And even with the flexibilities that USDA has given the state of Arizona, as well as other states across the country, for grab-and-go meal service or multiple meals at one time, we know that there were nearly 4 million fewer meals were served in April, according to the Department of Education. So we know the impact that this is having on getting meals to children, and we know that a corresponding increase in other programs like access to food banks, we've seen more and more families come to food banks and certainly more families coming to SNAP. So we know that some of those children that aren't getting access to school meals are coming to food banks. We also know that some of the children that aren't getting school meals at their school are getting benefits through SNAP or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So we know they're getting assistance in some other form, but we also know that there's a number of children who are struggling to make sure they get a consistent source of nutrition.
So childhood hunger in particular affected there, and it sounds like there are some specific challenges. Is it just as simple as sort of kids not being in the normal schools or summer settings that they're in and therefore not having the same kind of access to those free and reduced meals?
I think it's a couple of things. First of all, there's confusion. Parents aren't sure if their school is open, if they're providing meals. There's a lack of education, and we've been involved in a number of efforts to try and help with improving education about school meals right now. I think, too, transportation is a challenge. Now we're talking about getting children to schools at maybe not opportune times. You're not dropping your child off in the morning and then picking them up at the end of the day. You're having to go to school at maybe a lunchtime period and picking up those meals. That's a little different formula than we're used to. Mm-hmm. And I think finally, the heat always plays into it.
Yeah.
Our children who are older and maybe left at home to care for younger siblings, are they going to be able to walk four or five blocks to their school? Will they be able to get younger children to meals if they don't attend school at that site? So again, confusion, transportation, and heat, all barriers to getting kids meals.
Yeah, yeah. Were there obstacles that existed before the pandemic that are just sort of being exacerbated now?
Absolutely. We always had a challenge of making sure that every child in the school got fed. And what we would like to do now is start to advocate for more of a universal feeding model. We know that children are in school 7 or 8 hours a day, and making sure they have access to meals to make sure they can pay attention in class, get good grades, and obviously, have less visits to the school nurse. Those are all reasons why you'd want to be able to feed kids in schools.
Yeah. So let's talk then about resources. What resources are available to help alleviate childhood hunger, especially here in the Valley, and for that matter, to help get food and meals to their families?
Well, let's start with the one that's closest to my heart, which is the food banks. So the Arizona Food Bank Network has a website. You can go there, www.azfoodbanks.org. We're trying to keep that as up to date as possible, but we do encourage you to call first. If you go there, you type in your zip code, we'll be able to pop up the list of food banks that are available in your community. Two, making sure that you apply for SNAP, not just for yourself, but for your children. We're advocating for a 15% boost in that maximum monthly benefit so that more families get a little bit of extra help now that food prices are up just a little bit and you're having to pay for other additional services to make sure you get meals to you instead of you necessarily going to the grocery store. And the final thing for kids is the pandemic electronic benefits transfer, which is a really fancy way of basically saying, we want to make sure that you have enough money to be able to buy food in grocery stores. And in May, families received a pandemic EBT card in the mail. It reached a little over 570,000 school children. They're able to take those benefits, about $315, and spend them in grocery stores in the next couple of months. We're really trying to make sure that all eligible children receive them and that they know how to use them.
Schools, I know, have had those summer feeding programs running, like you mentioned, but they have to be sort of transitioned, I'm assuming, as the school year starts. Like, what might that mean for demand at the food banks? Like, what kind of pressure might that put on you?
We don't yet know what that kind of pressure will look like. Typically, when children return to schools, food banks go down a little bit because, of course, then children have a more regular access to those meals. However, we're unsure at this time what this is going to mean for us in the future, because if those children aren't attending school, will they still be getting those meals? Will they still return to normalcy? And what options do schools have in providing those meals? They typically, you know, don't, or if they're not returning to in-site or in-person schooling, what is that going to look like for a child who is at home all day and may not get that meal?
Yeah. Are there resources in place, Angie, that might not last much longer that are slated to go away?
There are a number of waivers that were in place for the summer feeding programs that will not continue past August at this time. We're encouraging Congress and the USDA to continue those waivers, but we don't yet know. And I think that leaves schools in a difficult position of trying to communicate what's going to happen to parents when they don't yet know.
All right. That is Angie Rogers, president and CEO of the Association of Arizona Food Banks, joining us to talk about childhood hungry and the way it's been affected by the pandemic. Angie, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. British officials plan to release a report this week that looks into allegations of Russian interference in the UK's Brexit vote in 2016. That's one of the top international stories of the coming days. And with me via Skype for our weekly look at some of them is the BBC's Rich Preston. And Rich, this report is scheduled to be released after a week in which Russia was accused of trying to steal details of a potential coronavirus vaccine from the UK, right?
Yeah, Russian meddling in foreign affairs. Sound familiar? Well, these allegations obviously have been going on for many months, both on your side of the pond and ours. We'll come to that report in a moment. But as you say, last week, British security sources accused Russian actors of trying to steal details of a coronavirus vaccine being jointly developed by the UK, the US and Canada. Now, first, let's get it out there. Russia completely refutes these allegations and says it's all part of anti-Russian propaganda. Nonetheless, the authorities here in the UK say that the particular group behind this act was APT29, codename Cozy Bear. Now that, Mark, is the same group that was implicated in hacking the DNC and was accused of meddling in the 2016 US presidential election. And when the story came out about the apparent attempt to steal vaccine data, the British government also said Russia had, quote, almost certainly sought to interfere in Britain's general election in 2019.
Well, Rich, and that brings us to this report in Russian interference in UK politics, right?
Yeah, and this is a long-awaited report. It's been on the boil for many months now. And while there have been accusations and claims of Russian meddling for a long time, what's been in short supply is hard evidence. And many are hoping that's what this report is going to contain. And you've got to remember, there's a particular sensitivity in the UK about Russian interference after the poisoning in 2018 of a former Russian spy and his daughter in a town in England, which was blamed on the Russian security services. Now, a couple of things to watch out for in this report. The main thing is the level of so-called interference that it provides evidence for. Is it just leaking documents, or is it out-and-out tampering with results? The consensus is that it's going to be somewhere in the middle. A bit of diplomatic manoeuvring, but a political undermining right the way through to the funding of movements, disinformation campaigns, spreading of false rumours and such like. Now, Russia openly backed Brexit, for example, but Moscow throughout said that was only because it supported Britain's independence from Europe. So this report is about just how far Russia went to subvert British democracy during the Brexit vote. Russia, as I say, completely denies these allegations, and Russia's ambassador to the UK, it was put to him in a BBC interview, and he said Russia sees no point in interfering in foreign matters. Now, just to finish up on this, a couple of key points to bear in mind. This is being released by an intelligence and security committee, not by the government. It's a step removed from the government. That's important. The other thing, yes, big headline news, this report is coming out, absolutely, but we don't know what we'll actually see in it. It is an intelligence report, after all. For all we know, Wednesday morning, 500 pages land, and it's all heavily redacted.
Right, interesting. All right, so Rich, on Thursday, we're expecting the sentencing in Germany of what looks like it might be the last trial of Nazi war crimes. What's the story there?
Yeah, this is the trial of a former concentration camp guard known as Bruno Day. He's 93 years old now, and the trial itself started back in October. It's been delayed because of his health and obviously because of coronavirus. Now, he was a guard at a Nazi death camp in what's now northern Poland, and he's accused of contributing to the murders of more than 5,000 people in the camp. He was 17 at the time. Now, incidentally, under German law, that means he's being trialed in a juvenile court. He admitted serving there, even admitted knowing at the time that atrocities were being carried out, but said he was not complicit in them. He also said he acknowledged that those being held in the camp were there for anti-Semitic, racist and other reasons, and even went as far as to say he felt compassion for them, but he argued that as an individual he was not in a position to free them. He has said he's sorry for what he did.
And this is obviously many years on from the end of World War II, the end of the Holocaust. This is perhaps the last time we could see a case like this, right?
That's right, Mark, for the simple reason that there are so few camp survivors and guards left, and those that are around, their age and health is obviously against them. But this is as relevant as ever. Now, Germany has not tried to hide its past. German leaders have long said the country needs to acknowledge what happened so that it can never happen again. Nonetheless, both in Germany and around the world, we've heard of a rise in anti-Semitism and a rise of the far right. And in fact, by complete coincidence, also in Germany this week, the trial begins of a man accused of shooting dead two people outside a synagogue in an anti-Semitic attack in Germany last year.
All right, Rich. Finally, that's happening Thursday. Let's move on to Friday. The first prayers will take place inside the Hagia Sophia in Turkey. That comes after the president there issued a decree that the building had to be converted into a working mosque after spending 80 years as a museum. It's been a fairly controversial story there, right?
That's right. This has been hugely controversial. Now, Turkey is a nation that's gone through many changes over the centuries. The Hagia Sophia symbolizes them all, really. It's an architectural jewel in Istanbul. Absolutely beautiful. I've been there myself. I was looking at photos last night of my time there. Now, it was built in the 6th century, originally as a working Christian cathedral. Then, with the Ottoman Empire in the 1400s, it became a mosque. And then in 1934, under the leader Ataturk, who transformed Turkey into a secular society, it became a museum and has been that way ever since. And it'd been a real symbol of Turkey's secularism. President Erdogan's decree undoes that. His critics say he's dismantling Turkey's secularism to the detriment of the nation, and this is seen as a symbolic move towards that. Worth saying, this plays very well to his conservative Turkish nationalist base.
All right, that is the BBC's Rich Preston. Rich, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. If you've got some spare change lying around or filling up your piggy bank, there are companies that would like to get their hands on it. There is a bit of a coin shortage in this country due to the coronavirus pandemic, and there are a few reasons for that. As states shut down parts of their economies, people weren't out and about spending money and circulating coins, for one. Also, the U.S. Mint wasn't producing as many coins as it was before COVID, and many bank lobbies where people redeem their coins have been closed. So that's led some companies to take different approaches to add change to their registers. Mike Thornbrew is manager of public and government affairs for the Quick Trip Corporation. He joins me to talk more about this. And Mike, what have your stores been seeing in terms of coins?
Well, it really kind of varies by market, to be very blunt with you. I mean, each market can have unique, you know, difficulties or opportunities, if you will. And really, I mean, how this thing all started, Mark, was we saw a press release by the chairman of the Federal Reserve warning everybody that there could be a coin shortage. So because of that, they start allocating, you know, the financial institutions' coins. Therefore, they begin to allocate us. So it really kind of moves from day to day and from market to market, if you will.
Are there particular markets in which your stores have had problems, have not had enough coins to make change or do what they need to do?
It's a little more unique than that. It's not necessarily each market. I mean, clearly you have some stores that are more credit card oriented than some of our other stores. And then conversely, you have, you know, a lot of stores that are kind of cash basis. So those are ones that are really running thin on coins. And we've had to do a lot of different things, you know, to try to make sure that we can take care of our customer.
What kinds of things have you had to do in those particular stores where you haven't had enough coins to make change?
Well, what we did is, I mean, we try to be proactive, number one. About 3 weeks ago, we put signage in all of our stores trying to inform and educate our customer that there could be problems. And we listed solutions on how they could help us get through this. I mean, number one is if you have the correct change, clearly we would appreciate it. You know, two is if you have to use a credit card or debit card, we understand. And if you could do that, we'd appreciate it. But then we went old school. Clearly, everybody's got coins, if you're like me, lying around somewhere in your car, you know, on top of your dresser. You know, check your sofa cushions and places like that. There's a lot of coins that are lying around. And if you have the opportunity to bring them in, we'll redeem those. And it's really been amazing, the customers that have come in and redeemed their coins with us. So that's been very helpful. But we've also taken it some other steps. Is if none of those situations work, you know, Quick Trip will do another three things. Number one, if we don't have the correct change that we owe you, we can print out a receipt with a barcode on it that shows the amount that we owe you that you can use for your next purchase, or we can give you a Quick Trip gift card that has that amount on there as well for your next purchase, or trying to make a bad situation positive. If a customer will allow us to round up whatever that purchase is, we will donate that to a charity that we're very active in called Folds of Honor. So we're trying to be creative and come up with solutions to make sure we take care of the customer.
I would imagine that this situation is not unique to Quick Trip. Have you heard from colleagues in other businesses or other maybe even sectors that have had similar problems?
No, you're right. Nobody's immune from it. If you're a retailer and you accept currency and coins, you know, you're going to be subject to it. I do think, though, that it probably has more an effect upon a convenience store industry. For the simple reason is, you know, a lot of purchases that we have by the customer is for a single item. You know, it may be a cup of coffee, a fountain drink, or something like that. And those normally are cash transaction or coin transactions versus a lot of some of the other businesses where the ticket price is much higher and people use their credit card. So it's, I don't want to use the word scrambling because we're not, because we have a plan in place, but it's something that we wish didn't happen. It is what it is. We're trying to make the very best of it.
So you mentioned that some customers have actually been redeeming coins. Like, are they using Quick Trip kind of like Coinstar or something where they'd bring in like a bucket full of pennies and nickels and stuff and they get something back from you?
Yeah, the difference is Coinstar, I mean, they keep 10% of it, right? We don't. When we're paying you, you bring us 100 pennies, you know, we're going to pay the dollar amount. And it has been amazing that a lot of people are coming in and they're helping out. For instance, to give an example, we had one individual in Wichita, Kansas, that called us, and he had over $3,000 worth of coins.
Wow.
Clearly, we had to get with our people to make sure we had that kind of money. But those are the kinds of things that you're seeing. People are just coming in and redeeming coins and helping us out. And in the same time, they don't want to walk around with that much coin. So we're both helping each other, quite frankly.
So what are you hearing from folks either at the banks with which you work or maybe from the Fed in terms of trying to get more coins into circulation so this problem abates somewhat?
I can't say the Feds. The Feds, I mean, they're obviously they're going to do what they can do by getting more production the best that they can. But then you run into logistics. The banks are really having the same problem as we are, and we're working with them very closely, and they're doing the very best that they can of getting these coins recirculated right back into the marketplace. A lot of them, depending again on where you operate, they're back open, their lobbies are open, so their coin redemption machines are running, I'm sure, around the clock.
Is this something that you have ever seen before? Like, have you been in this kind of situation before?
No, I've been with Quick Trip almost 26 years, and I've never seen anything like this before. And I don't think that as we were all going through, you know, dealing with COVID, that anybody even thought about there could be a potential coin shortage. So it's another unfortunate byproduct. But this is one that everybody, if we work together, we can fix. So hopefully it's short-lived. We really haven't had that many problems, but you will from time to time have some places, you know, that will be short or they'll be out of certain coins of a certain denomination.
All right. That is Mike Thornbrew. He's manager of public and government affairs with Quick Trip Corporation. Mike, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Mark, I really appreciate it very much.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.